Welcome to The Philosopher's Nest. I'm Lewis Williams.
And I'm Kyle Van Ostrom.
The Philosopher's Nest is a podcast that showcases the work, insights, and experiences of graduate students in philosophy. This podcast is generously supported by the American Philosophical Association, the Faculty of Philosophy at the University of Oxford, and Lineker College, Oxford. Today, we're going to be joined by David Dominguez, a PhD candidate at the Complutense University of Madrid. We'll be talking about David's experiences as a schoolteacher in philosophy alongside his PhD, as well as his doctoral research on the zetetic turn in epistemology. If you'd like to get in touch with David, you can reach him via email at davdom04@ucm.es, and you can also read his publications linked on his Phil Papers profile.
David Dominguez, welcome to the Philosopher's Nest.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great. You mentioned that you got into philosophy when you were at secondary school in Spain, which is where I've lived my whole life. So that's kind of a fun commonality we have there. I didn't study philosophy in Spain. Unfortunately, I didn't get to do it myself. But what sort of philosophical ideas do secondary students at Spain look at?
Here in Spain, we have two philosophy courses in secondary school, the last 2 years before going to uni. And the second to last year, there is like an overview of the main topics of philosophy. We have this topic-based approach in which the students get to learn some things about the theory of knowledge, metaphysics, philosophy of science, and then some practical areas like ethics and political philosophy. Very basic things, but a very nice overview. And then the last year before going to university, we have history of philosophy, which is a subject where mainly we see are the main authors of the Western canon, Plato, Aristotle, etc. So you have this historical overview and this topic-based overview, and somehow you get to see a little bit of everything. There's no special subject on which you focus more than others. So that there's this big bird's eye view of the discipline.
Yeah, that bird's eye view is reminiscent, I think, of the way that we studied philosophy in A-level in the UK as well. And not only did you study philosophy at school, but you're now teaching it at school as well, alongside your doctoral work. How's that working?
Well, it depends on the year you ask. This school year is being a bit hard, but it mainly depends on the students you get each year, how everything is going in every other domain. But it's the eighth year that I've been teaching philosophy at the secondary school. And so far, I'm quite happy with my job, yeah.
I'm curious how teaching philosophy in a school relates to teaching philosophy to undergraduates at a university. Have you done any teaching of undergraduates at the university alongside your studies?
No, I haven't had the chance to teach at university. So I don't know. I guess one of the main differences might be that when you teach an undergraduate, you teach somebody who has already decided that they have an interest in philosophy and they might want to pursue a career in philosophy. On the other hand, when you're teaching at high school, you have to teach to people who might not like the subject, who maybe don't know anything about it. And there's like this kind of seduction work you have to do in order to get them to love the subject, or at least not to hate it too much, let's say.
Yeah, I'd be curious about that, just kind of following up, because I guess, I mean, over 8 years of teaching, there's been an explosion of very addictive technologies and websites and things. And I'm just wondering, have you observed any like differing tendencies in, I guess, students' abilities to engage with what you're teaching? Or like, does that present its own challenges?
Definitely, especially after the pandemic. I have my own subjective experience, but if you look at statistics, like, for instance, I don't know, there was this PISA report not so long ago from the OECD. Everything points out to the conclusion that the attention span of students is shortening somehow. What I see in my classes is that maybe reading comprehension and the ability to write long texts is not the same as 4 or 5 years ago. So there is an issue with this stuff. And also in the last 2-3 years, we have observed more cases of mental health issues from some of the students, etc. So yeah, I think it's having an impact. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. I mean, if I can ask even a further follow-up, I guess the other thing that would definitely have an impact, or well, actually, I don't know, maybe you tell me if there is some impact, I guess the rise of ChatGPT. And have you picked up any students using ChatGPT yet?
Yeah. Well, I have a tendency not to make them make many papers at home because this is something that happened even before ChatGPT. ChatGPT, it's just the way things have changed with ChatGPT is that you cannot track the source of what you know that what they have presented is not something they have done. Before, you could track it to some page from where they have retrieved it. Now you cannot do that, but it's something that you can see that is not, they have not done what they have presented to you. So I've always avoided sending them many tasks for home because of this reason. I try to make them maybe write their papers at the classroom, etc. But yeah, you can see that they try to use ChatGPT, for instance, when they have to comment some text in an exam, and they know that in the exam they might have this text from Plato to comment or from Aristotle. They go to ChatGPT, they introduce the text, and ChatGPT is not able to give very deep commentaries, ancient philosophical texts. So you see that what they write in the exam makes no sense. Yeah. That they are not, they could not have been able to do it on their own. And so you can infer where they have taken it from.
As someone who has two parents who have always been school teachers, I can see that teaching is a hard job. It's time consuming, right? And to do that alongside a PhD, you know, blimey, how does that work for you? How do you manage your time working, you know, a full-time job alongside a rigorous doctoral program as well?
Well, you have your ups and downs because also throughout the year, when you're a school teacher, there are peaks of very heavy workload, and then there are times when your tasks are not so consuming. When you have spent quite a few years teaching, you have a lot of material already prepared that you use from one year to the other. The main problem maybe will be to organize yourself as well as you can. There is always time for reading, for instance. The main problem is with finding time for writing. But the good thing is that we have quite long holidays at summer and Christmas and in Easter, and you can use it for writing. If you organize your time in a proper way, you can somehow structure your readings throughout the year in a way that you are prepared to maybe advance a lot in the paper when you are at home at Christmas or in summer, and try to take all the profit that you can take from those moments in which you don't have as much work as maybe at the end of a school term when you have all this grading to do, etc.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, it sounds like you're doing a good job of balancing these things. We've had guests in the past, such as Carrie Langsdale, was an episode that came out a few. Well, actually, was that last season? Must have been last season. Who spoke to us about the difficulties of, you know, maintaining a full job and doing our PhD. You know, I guess the tricky thing of being like, it's tough to maybe go for extracurricular things like going to conferences and stuff like that might be a little trickier.
Yeah, that's also something that having a full-time job, it constrains how many conferences you can send papers to or you can attend. And so far, I haven't been able to, for instance, attend a conference abroad. I've been going to some here in Spain, and it's something that I would like to do in the future, but you have this limitation because the job doesn't allow you to just take a plane to somewhere at any moment.
Yeah, sure. Nevertheless, it seems like you've not been inhibited too much. You've been able to publish a paper in a major journal like Synthesa? Yeah. Synthese? Who knows?
I don't actually know how it's pronounced.
I actually never know. I
think it's Synthese, yeah.
Yeah, it's like German, right?
Well, I imagine. Synthese, yeah. With my basic British
Synthese.
Accent.
Synthese. Yeah, so you managed to publish a paper there, which is a paper within the doctoral research that you are doing.
Yeah.
Which is on the relationship between norms of inquiry and norms of belief. So let's just start off by unpacking this term inquiry. What is inquiry?
Well, in a very general sense, to inquire into something, well, you inquire into questions. You engage in inquiry when you have some question you're curious about, you don't know the answer, and you take the necessary steps to answer the question properly. Maybe you try to gather evidence. Maybe you use different methods of deliberation, reasoning. Maybe you have the answer at hand and just retrieve it from your memory or whatever. Well, the process of inquiry is the one which opens when you are curious about some question and closes in the moment that you finally settle on some answer to the question.
Okay, to get a grip then on the distinction between what we might call synthetic epistemology pertaining to inquiry and traditional epistemology pertaining to belief, Is traditional epistemology then kind of a subtype of Zetetic epistemology? If Zetetic epistemology is looking into this wider process of inquiry that ends in the belief that traditional epistemology looks at squarely.
Well, the thing is, Friedman introduces this term because she claims that epistemology, at least the way it has been practiced in the analytical tradition in the last half century or so, it has focused too narrowly on how we go about forming our beliefs, or maybe how we respond to our evidence by revising the beliefs we have, or its focus has been on the states of belief themselves, whether they are true or not true, justified or not justified, whether they constitute knowledge or not. And what she claims is that if we are to make some sense of why we engage in epistemology at all, we have to somehow, say, frame this kinds of assessment in the kind of activity which gives sense to these assessments, which is that we are inquirers who ask questions about the world that surrounds us, maybe out of pure curiosity or because we have some practical interest in some kind of question. And then inquiry in its whole scope, in its whole span, instead of just the moment in which we form a belief or we revise the beliefs we have, should be under the scope of the discipline and not just this narrow part of the end of inquiry in which we settle to some belief or other. We could say that the idea of a Zetetic epistemology is the idea of an expanded epistemology, which in a way goes beyond what epistemologists, at least in the analytic tradition in the last 50 years or so, have been doing.
Okay, great. So can you give us an example where, let's say, approaching some case of people trying to figure out something about the world looks different in the case of traditional epistemology as opposed to Zetetic epistemology? So give us like a practical example where we see the difference between, let's say, inquiring and believing.
The idea here would be that when you engage in inquiry, you normally don't have settled into some kind of belief about the question you're inquiring into yet. So you're in a state of suspension and you're trying to find an answer. So the main difference, let's say, is that if you go for a Zetetic approach or some kinds of Zetetic approach, you would contemplate activities like gathering evidence as somehow under the scope of epistemic assessment, but belief would still be there at the end of the process. Whereas if you understand that epistemology has to do only with the beliefs we have or how our beliefs fit the evidence you have, in some way, which inquiries you have open or are out of the scope, and the activity of gathering evidence, for instance, is not under the scope of epistemic assessment. So one kind of example in which traditional epistemologists who would like to leave inquiry outside of the scope of the discipline and a Zetetic epistemologist would somehow understand things in a different way would be cases of what sometimes is called normative defeat, which is cases of beliefs that might be justified by the evidence that you have, but cases in which maybe because of the inquiries you should have engaged in, because of your position in society or wherever, or the overall context, there is evidence you didn't gather enough evidence. And so some of those who are more prone to the Zetetic approach would say that maybe even if the belief you ended up forming fits the evidence you have, your belief is defective. It's incorrect, it's unjustified, because there is some evidence you should have gathered that you failed to gather. The difference between the traditional approach maybe and the more Zetetic one would be that the traditional epistemologist would say that your failure in these kind of cases would be maybe more practical than epistemic, and the Zetetic one would say, well, since we epistemologists are engaged with assessing inquiry in its whole scope, the failure would be epistemic, not just practical.
Mm. Yeah, thanks. That's illuminating. And I can totally see the benefit of taking that approach. The context that we're talking about then is one in which epistemologists have undertaken what some people have described as a Zetetic turn in recent years.
Yes.
In your own research, what's the turn that you make? What is it that we should be focusing on or should be thinking about that we haven't been yet?
The paper I published is actually an assessment of this idea of taking a Zetetic turn. First of all, to clarify, some people will talk about the Zetetic turn in a more wide sense than the one they use in the paper, which is that when epistemologists just attend to questions of inquiry and norms of inquiry, they are taking the synthetic turn. The proposal I engage with in the paper is, which is Friedman's own, she defends that the synthetic and the epistemic, so norms of inquiry and norms of belief, form a unified domain in the strong sense that all synthetic norms are epistemic and all epistemic norms are synthetic. Epistemic norms are norms of inquiry. And that's the sense in which I talk about the synthetic turn in the paper. I say that I call, in this more narrow sense, the synthetic turn to the idea or the proposal that epistemic norms are norms of inquiry. And what I try to do in the paper is to defend that this is not a turn that we should take, that even though there are strong motivations or good motivations for the turn, they are not enough to embrace such a radical view because of all the revisionary implications that it has, and because we can somehow honor the motivations behind the turn without taking it.
Let's discuss those motivations, but first, just to see some of the reservations some people might have about the synthetic turn, sort of focusing on inquiry. It seems to me like it just can't be that all synthetic norms are epistemic, or sorry, like everything that's synthetic is epistemic, right? Because it seems like there are things relating to inquiry that don't have to do anything with epistemology, right? So it seems like there are things you can do, such as eat a certain amount of food that powers your brain in certain ways so that you can inquire into particular things. But like, doesn't seem like anything there is epistemic in nature, but it does seem like it's related to the process of inquiry. So, you know, how can we say everything synthetic is epistemic? Is that part of the sort of skepticism you have about it?
Yeah, it's part of the skepticism that not only me, but many of the other people that are engaged in these discussions have advanced the idea that if you understand that all synthetic things are epistemic, then since inquiry is an activity with an end, then everything that somehow optimizes the chances that you get to that end would also be epistemic. But there are many things that seem thoroughly practical in nature that can help you to succeed in your inquiries that don't seem to be epistemic at all. And that's what one example. I think it's called the sandwich reasons problem.
Okay.
you can have epistemic reasons to eat sandwiches if you're hungry, and by eating a sandwich, you would end your inquiry in a more satisfactory and maybe more quick way, which doesn't make sense if you understand that what defines what is epistemic or not has to do with some sorts of values with like the truth, the knowledge, etc., which don't seem to have too many things to do with eating a sandwich.
Right.
Yeah, so that seems one way we can push against the synthetic turn then. That seems to be a way of pushing against it by arguing that, you know, some of these things that come under what we might call synthetic epistemology don't actually seem epistemic in nature. But, you know, maybe somebody could say, okay, fine, maybe you don't want to call this epistemology proper, but it's still an interesting endeavor. It's still illuminating to think about. Do you think that kind of response could work? Or is there some other deeper issues at play as well that speak against this reorientation of philosophy and epistemology towards inquiry?
It might be a good answer, but the concern I have there is that, yeah, you could say it is important in its own way to understand how we inquire and how we can improve our proficiency in inquiring. And there is a good point that not only Friedman, but for instance, Nathan Ballantyne also makes, which is that historically, if we go to the works of the likes of Plato, Locke, Descartes, when they engage in the investigations about the nature, the limits, the scope of our ability to know, somehow their deep aim is to improve our ability as inquirers, which is something that I think it's a point that we have to take. But the problem here is that if we understand that we are talking about a single normative domain, I believe that we are missing important distinctions. And that even if inquiry as a subject matter can somehow be the object of a discipline, so to say, there are practical and epistemic considerations meshed up in this subject matter. And it is important to somehow distinguish between them and maybe understand or try to understand how they interact with each other, but without going for the unity view that Friedman defends, in which the synthetic is epistemic and the epistemic is synthetic.
Okay, that's a nice way of seeing what like the practical relevance of keeping them distinguished, that is the zetetic and the sort of doxastic way of doing epistemology. Yeah. To, you know, further push for them, do you think that, I guess, whether we believe or whether we inquire seems to, in the real world, require the assistance of others? And so it seems like testimony, which is, you know, important for, let's say, forming justified beliefs, but also important for inquiring in some ways. Can testimony bring inquiry back into the epistemic again? How does the concept of testimony figure into your research?
Well, basically, in the paper, what I defend is the opposite, that testimony puts pressure on the zetetic framework, at least Friedman's, because what she defends that somehow inquiry or the way you have inquired has some weight, has some consequences on the permissibility of the resulting beliefs that you end up having in a very strong way. It is not only that if you have inquired badly and you haven't gathered enough evidence, your resulting beliefs are not justified enough, but if you inquire into something that was not especially important given your overall zetetic interests, given which questions have priority within your research agenda, or maybe the case that she gives in her paper is one in which there is a person who has to count the windows in a building, we don't know why, and they start forming beliefs about their surroundings, and the inquiry into the windows is the important thing. So since inquiry is an activity with an aim, and we should try to optimize how we try to achieve that aim by forming beliefs about their surroundings, this person who has to count the windows, they are forming impermissible beliefs because their inquiry obliges them somehow to focus on the task at hand. So what I say in the paper is that the fact that we are engaged in testimonial practices and that some people can ask for a testimony somehow puts pressure on this view, because our epistemic interdependence, the fact that we need information from others, others need information from us, can give an independent basis for norms and forming beliefs that maybe can stand even in cases where forming those beliefs goes against our zetetic interests.
That makes sense.
That's what I tried to defend in one of the cases I present in the paper.
Well, yeah, that makes complete sense. So I'm happy to say that diffuses the objection or the concern. So well done. In any case, David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Philosopher's Nest. You can find our website at www.philosophersnest.com, and if you're a graduate philosophy student who might like to come on and join us for an episode, feel free to reach out to us at thephilosophersnest@gmail.com.